Welcome back to the Clean Techies Podcast, where we interview climate tech founders and VCs to discuss all things building and investing to solve the biggest challenge of our generation, climate change. On this episode, we had the chance to speak with Luke Shores, co-founder of Capture 6. Capture 6 is a direct air carbon capture company applying their innovative technology and business model to revolutionize the way that carbon capture takes place. One of their claims to fame is their approach on being efficient with water usage and creating beneficial byproducts from their carbon capture process. Luke himself is actually not a deep tech founder and shares great insights on how he navigated building a deep tech company in climate. This episode gave us a lot to think about regarding the ways that we can think outside of the box of traditional approaches to things like carbon capture and combine it with other processes that can create extra revenue streams that ultimately help scale the business. Generally speaking, a really fascinating episode. Let us know your favorite parts when you finish listening. Enjoy the show.
All right. Welcome to the show, Luke. How's it going today?
Great, Silas. Thank you.
We are pretty excited to have you on. I'm trying to think. I don't know when the last time we had a pure carbon capture type play on here. So this is going to be interesting. It's been a second. But I guess let's just kick right into things. Give us a quick kind of background on who you are, you know, and what you're doing today.
Sure. So my background's pretty broad. I've worked in a lot of different countries. I've kind of spent my professional career in, you know, health, education, and climate. And I recognize that's a really broad range, but I've kind of always been interested in these challenges that straddle multiple domains. So, you know, for instance, one of my first climate projects was on soot. And that was really interesting to me because you had cook stoves in low-income countries that were emitting soot. It was, you know, landing on snow, changing surface albedo. And it was this problem that encompassed health, climate, and education, because at an education level, you know, villagers often weren't familiar or aware, or they didn't have the ability to appreciate that this soot was harmful to their health. I say they didn't have the ability to appreciate because they didn't have the economic privilege to do so. You know, it was a health problem because it was responsible for emphysema and asthma, and it was a climate problem. And so these sorts of issues, where do they fall? Like who owns that issue in kind of, you know, worlds that are siloed in different agencies? So, you know, these kind of complex problems that encompass different domains I've often found interesting. This company came to be just during the COVID era. I met some friends. We, you know, rented a house in Utah and we were doing some hikes, and you know, just a friend of mine, I just kind of on a hike said we should collaborate on something sometime. And it was just one of those comments that just kind of emerged from a good conversation, but it didn't have a, you know, a particular focus or, you know, let's do something tomorrow. But I think that comment kind of there, that was a seed. And, you know, he reached out about 3 months later and said, "Do you still want to collaborate on something?" I said, "Sure." You know, I was doing some consulting at the time for the World Bank. And we just started talking about the direct air capture space. And, you know, we sort of began with this kind of process of thinking about what we didn't want to do in that space, you know. So we didn't want to create a DAC solution that consumed lots of fresh water. We didn't want to do a DAC solution that operated at high temperatures, because we knew that operating at high temperatures meant that we wouldn't be able to use fully intermittent renewable power. We didn't want to do a DAC solution that required complex supply chains or had very weird proprietary materials that, you know, might be really cool at a lab, but might be difficult to scale in the near term. So we sort of started with, you know, let's avoid this. And then by kind of backing into, you know, what we didn't want to do, we eventually emerged with what we did want to do. And so that was kind of the origin of Capture Six. The backstory to that name, which is just kind of random and funny, is I had to save a Word document when, you know, before we'd even launched this. And, you know, the word processing prompted me for a name. And I just, you know, thought, oh, carbon's the, you know, atomic number six. So I just wrote Capture Six and I sent it to my friend, and his name's Ethan Cohen Cole. And he just went and just incorporated the company under that name. So we didn't have any like grand seance in the desert, or, you know, didn't do a focus group. But in many ways, that was like, I think that was a good thing. It's like there's so many decisions to make as a startup, and you can't agonize over every decision if you want to make progress. So Capture Six was, you know, kind of born on paper as a public benefit corporation. And that was kind of our attempt to create a structure where we could have the incentives of a for-profit company, but kind of retain the mission of a, you know, a not-for-profit. And so, you know, we incorporated as as a public benefit corporation, like, you know, Patagonia. And it started as a hobby project, and I was still doing all my consulting. And then, you know, within 2 months, we had raised $3 million, and, you know, I dropped all of my other consulting, and it, you know, it's been kind of off to the races ever since.
Impact brands represent the choice to live our lives in alignment with planetary action and our values, to preserve our amazing home for generations to come. Be it through solar panels, how you travel, where you're sourcing your materials, the choices we make matter. And I know you know that if you're listening to this podcast. My name is Anna Konstantinova, and I'm on a mission to make impact brands our next paradigm. I believe that marketing can be used for us rather than against us, and I want to help you build the best brand possible so we can all pour our strength into solving the biggest issue of our time. Whether you're a founder or an investor representing portfolio companies, let's work together to make sure your brand is seen, heard, and remembered the way it deserves to be. And as a thank you to the Clean Techies community, I'm offering 20% off my newest launch, Branding Sessions, with code CLEANTECHIES, one word. We'll take 60 or 90 minutes to solve one specific problem, whether it be a naming issue, strategy development, business growth, or beyond. Let's put our minds together and move forward with renewed energy. Can't wait to hear what you're working on. Find me at anako.co. That's ANNAKO.CO. Talk soon.
You know, before I get into that good stuff, I definitely think Capture Six, it's a cool name. It's cool that you guys were able to get it so quickly, and that it started off that way. I feel like sometimes the name makes a big difference, even like in remembering episodes, remembering companies. You'd be surprised how far away that goes. So Capture Six definitely rolls off the tongue, I feel like. You talked about, you know, it's really interesting how you started talking about the things that you eliminated when you were looking at the potential solutions, right? And that probably takes some understanding of the current landscape. I'd say that's a pretty unorthodox process. I don't know if every founder really considers that. In doing that, I'm guessing there becomes a gap where, okay, you've understood what you don't want to do, but now the question becomes, what do you want to do? And because you've eliminated what likely is a large number of solutions, you're left with kind of this hole. And what I would assume is maybe a lack of confidence. So my question is to that point, using this approach, because I think it's actually a very interesting contrarian approach, how did you become confident in the solution that you were going to pursue?
Yeah, I mean, some of this, of course, just gets to you know, our background as founders. So my co-founder, Ethan, is an economist by training. He was a Federal Reserve regulator. He was a professor of finance at the University of Maryland, and then he ran a financial advisory firm that he, you know, grew up and sold. So, you know, we're not material scientists. We didn't come out of a material science lab where we discovered a new a new particular sorbent or something like that, a new, organic framework for capturing CO2. So we instead approach this as a business problem, which is there's, a demand for permanent carbon removal now. We know, for instance, companies like Microsoft have 2030 net zero commitments. They're buying carbon removal. So we know the demand exists now, even if it's among a, for the moment, maybe that's concentrated in a number of kind of benevolent corporates, but that demand exists. And that demand is not for a, a 1 kilogram of removal from a lab, right? If you go to one of those big companies and say, here's my, box and I can remove a kilogram of CO2, they're not going to be interested because that's not going to help them meet their targets. So we came at this at what exists at a high technology readiness level that can be deployed today that, can be brought into a different configuration to accomplish this kind of novel goal of direct air capture. So it was more thinking from a, an industrial perspective and an economic perspective than it was coming from a R&D perspective.
Hey there. Quick break to remind any founders or VCs listening. If you are looking for deal flow, seeking to raise funding, looking for partners to help service your needs, or perhaps you're looking for corporate investment partners, feel free to reach out to us through our Slack channel, which can be found in the description. Because we meet a lot of people in this space, we set aside time each week to make introductions to the various people that we encounter. This is something we do free of charge in order to help these incredible companies solving climate change to scale. Looking forward to hearing from you in the Slack channel.
This is quite interesting. Can you talk more about this? So you're both neither of you are materials people, right? This is always what I think. I'm like, if I want to start a climate startup someday, I don't know how I'm going to do that. I'm not an engineer. I'm not a scientist. So how do you go about? You obviously have some understanding of the landscape of how things are working. There's demand, but then you go and find a technology that's there. Can you talk more about that? How did you source that? What's that process like for other people who may have similar types of backgrounds looking to solve solutions in the climate space, or solve problems in the climate space?
Sure. So something that was said to me a long time ago that I found kind of helpful was, you can think of climate change as a temperature problem, but you can also think of it as an acid-base problem. And carbon dioxide is an acid, and we have too much acid in the atmosphere, and we have too much acid in the oceans. And we need to transform some of that acid into, terrestrial geologic storage. So the base that, we use is called sodium hydroxide. And, this is also known as lye. And this is a very common chemical. It's produced all over the world. It's used in soaps and lots of other things. And so it's been known for 100 plus years that sodium hydroxide has the ability to bond to CO2 and create sodium carbonate. So the idea of using sodium hydroxide to capture CO2 was not novel. That is known. The question is, how do you do that at scale very, very cheaply in a way that can be deployed? And so that is, that's an engineering problem, but it's also just a, business problem. And so that's where we were able to kind of utilize our strengths of thinking through how do you structure these projects? What do the, economics of these projects look like? Now, in using kind of off-the-shelf equipment to accomplish this goal, of course, over time, we can try and optimize some of this equipment for this, particular goal. So to give an example, the, cooling towers that we will use that will expose the sodium hydroxide to the air are not actually optimized for this task. They're optimized for, heat transfer. And what we need is to optimize something for mass transfer. So we have engineers that are, taking this equipment and thinking about what is the next version of this look like? And right now we've got 22 staff, and so we've got 8 engineers and scientists, and so on the technical side, it's grown significantly beyond our original conceptualization of the technology. But that's kind of how our thought process led us to this point.
So was there a specific, it sounds like you had some level of technical understanding of how this works. Is this just a base kind of well-known method of capturing carbon that's, it's not proprietary, and you just said, hey, we can take this and go run with it and make it more refined? Hey there. Are you building a climate tech business and looking for very specialized talent? Consider reaching out to our sponsors, NextWave Partners. NextWave are experts in talent acquisition, recruitment, and retention across the climate tech, renewables, and ESG spaces globally. So if your team is growing or you're looking to make a career change yourself, feel free to reach out to NextWave at next-wavepartners.com or reach out to one of their consultants directly via their LinkedIn page.
Well, our process for producing sodium hydroxide is unique. But it does utilize kind of unit technologies that others have developed at, large scale with high technology readiness levels. So the basic approach of our process is to take a saltwater input, and we strip out the salt, the NaCl, and then we have H2O. We separate the hydrogen from the hydroxide through electrochemical processes, which are well known and well understood. At that point, we combine back the sodium with the hydroxide to create sodium hydroxide, and that is our solvent. So we're somewhat unique among direct air carbon capture groups in that we do not recycle our solvent. So we're not, in many groups' processes, what they do is they use a solvent or a sorbent. They absorb CO2, they heat that back up, it re-releases the CO2, and then they store that in something, a geological formation, which is called like a class 6 well typically. What we and there's the problem with that approach is over time there's degradation of that sorbent or solvent, so it becomes less effective in capturing CO2. We have basically a linear process where we're constantly generating the solvent, and so we're constantly mineralizing the CO2. That has some advantages because we don't have to be close to a, particular geologic formation because you can store this mineral anywhere. So there's lots of articles in the media now about different places that are considering building CO2 pipelines. So in California, there's a discussion of whether they should build a CO2 pipeline. In Iowa, there's discussion about a CO2 pipeline. And this is presented as this is a, it's a very tough decision. We need a CO2 pipeline to store, CO2. And on the other hand, communities don't necessarily want a pipeline running through their backyard. We sort of bypass this discussion because we create a mineral from the CO2. So we're not ultimately dependent upon class 6 wells for storing the CO2.
So just to double tap on that, to make sure I understand, it sounds like there's a, I think, three key differentiators within the process. So it's the ability to use that water consumption or a different form of water consumption to create this recurring solvent, which is essentially what you're used to store throughout this intermediary process. And then that also helps you in terms of like how you need to store. So essentially the real innovation here is almost the portability of the entire process. Is that accurate?
That's accurate. And I would add to that, What are the economics of these projects? And so one answer is the economics of these projects is exclusively based upon carbon removal credits. And indeed, you can build such projects purely based upon the purchase of carbon dioxide removal. In the United States, it's even easier to do that because you have the Inflation Reduction Act now that provides $180 tax credit per ton of CO2 removed. However, you can't build projects in many places in the world purely based upon carbon removal credits. And even in the US, it's hard. So the economics of our projects are not just based upon carbon removal. We also, because we basically squeeze out water from this salty brine, that fresh water has economic value. And in addition, the brine management is something that has costs in many places. So in our first project, which will break ground in the first quarter of 2024 in LA County, in a place called Palmdale, they were looking at leasing many acres of land for salt evaporation ponds. And so that was their discharge from their water treatment facility. And those brine evaporation ponds have no economic value. It's purely cost. So that's their effectively was going to be their garbage. So in our process, we transform that to sodium carbonate, which is much more easy to store. It doesn't have the same environmental damages of storing, salt. And so these become basically economic benefits of our process that are totally independent of carbon removal.
Hey there, thanks for listening to this episode. If you made it this far, it's likely that you're enjoying the show, so I wanted to ask your help. If you're enjoying it, please give us a review on Apple Podcasts and share with somebody in the same industry who might find this interesting. And if you're interested in getting summaries of these episodes, go subscribe to our newsletter that comes out on LinkedIn and Substack. Links can be found in the description. Thanks for your help in growing the reach of this show.
This is pretty fascinating. I've never heard of a carbon capture company that found the economic incentive to save somebody money. So this is quite fascinating. So just to, I want to try to conceptualize this. I'm a very visual person. So the projects essentially, what do they look like? Is this a kind of a small pond where you can take this stuff? Can you just like for if you're explaining to our grandmas, right? How does it look, this project, if in kind of concept when you see these things all around the world someday?
Okay, so people don't generally like to drink salt water, right? So I'll start there. And so, there's a variety of water sources. Low salinity water is also known as brackish water, or you have true desalinization, which is taking ocean water. In any event, you have a salt problem, right? So in any water treatment facility that is dealing with salt, they are removing that salt. But you can remove that salt up to a point. And then at some point, the salt becomes concentrated enough in the water that it ceases to be economically viable to treat it further. And so that becomes kind of the waste stream. So essentially, if you have an input salty water stream, the water treatment facility emerges with two streams. It emerges with the fresh water stream, which is what people want, and the concentrated brine stream, which is the garbage essentially from that facility. If it's located on the coast, in many cases, these plants are permitted to just discharge that brine back into the ocean. But that's not something that generally communities are, thrilled about, right? And you have activism among surfers and scuba divers and other community groups because it's known that this brine discharge hurts marine life. And for new projects that aren't already permitted, this is the source of substantial scrutiny. particularly in shallow bodies of water. So, for instance, in the Middle East, you have shallow bodies of water where you have massive desalinization operations. And over time, all that brine discharge just increases the salinity of that whole body of water. Inland, that brine is typically dealt with in these salt evaporation ponds. So in any event, you have this brine problem. And what we do in a way is we make it economical to treat that brine and to transform it. So it's not so much that we manage it, it's that we use up those salts. And so we can generate fresh water from a source of water that was no longer economical to deal with in a traditional way.
Okay. So this would be almost like your objective is to make essentially a bolt-on plant to these desalinization plants that can further take out the salt, produce more fresh water, so they're able to have more economic benefit as a commercial operation, but also save the money from having to rent land to dry out to salt flats, right? Is that correct?
That's all correct. And there's, there's other things you can do. So in some ways that's, phase one. What are some of the other things you can do? The outputs of our process, by a happy coincidence, some of them are actually used in water treatment. So water treatment uses sodium hydroxide. It uses sodium carbonate. We produce some dilute acid that is used by water treatment to clean membranes. So you can create some nice circular economy synergies. And in doing so, you can also reduce the emissions of the water treatment facility by providing them effectively low carbon chemicals on site.
This is pretty cool. I this is pretty fascinating. So now I want to talk about you mentioned earlier that you built this not just on the idea of selling carbon credits, right? So can we talk about are these projects, even if you completely take away people buying carbon credits, will these projects be viable for those desalinization plants? They want this that much that it's going to be that valuable for them to invest in it?
Well, I should be careful about how I answer this one because it's kind of a funny, it's a funny thing right now in carbon markets. So traditionally in nature-based solutions, there's this concept of additionality. And so the idea is that buyers of credits want credits that are additional. Now, this makes tons of sense in the case of, say, reforestation, right? Because trees grow whether we plant them or not. Seeds fall and acorns grow into oak trees, and that oak tree wasn't dependent upon a carbon credit, for its growth. So it makes sense to ask the question, would that tree or would that forest have existed in the absence of this carbon credit? But that concept is being applied to direct air capture as well. And I think it's more questionable in that context because these facilities are not going to just build themselves. So there's no counterfactual where you say, would this facility have existed in the absence of any action? No, it wouldn't, because facilities don't build themselves. But if you truly got to the point where there was no cost of doing carbon removal, that these facilities were purely financeable just on water and dealing with brine waste, then would companies buy the carbon removal credits? Now, I think the answer is, yes. If I can sell, if all it co takes is $1 per ton of CO2 removed, that's great. That means that we've effectively, massively lowered the price of carbon removal. But at the moment, there is this criterion and grants and applications. Is this project, is this investment in carbon removal financially additional? In other words, would this facility exist without the carbon removal purchase. Now, we can honestly answer that no, the facility would not exist without the carbon removal purchase. But if I present it as being, too good of a thing, strangely enough, it scares away some of the carbon removal purchasers.
Yeah, I think this is kind of interesting. You have a little bit of a misalignment of incentives, right? Because you're trying to make sure you do the right thing and have good compliance with the carbon markets, right? Which is notorious for having a couple issues in it, right? But at the same time, you're able to do something and hypothetically fund things that probably would not get funded because if there was less incentive to do it, they might say, well, we're not going to try something new. We're just going to do things the way we've done them. So I do want to get through the rest of the technology here. So I want to get down to the point of what it, on your website, it mentions that this is a model for commercial success. So at what carbon price are these projects viable, and what is the price of carbon per ton removed that you guys can get to based on your current calculations? Because I know you said you're building a pilot project, so it's probably just bench ideas right now.
Yeah, so I mean, there is no one cost of carbon removal for our projects because, any project has it's a question, what is the value of the brine management? What is the value of the fresh water? If the value of those is high, then the cost of the carbon removal becomes much lower. If the value of those is not as great, then the cost of carbon removal is higher. So to give you an example, in the case of a desalinization plant, it may already be permitted to discharge brine in the ocean. So that's not a good thing, but from their perspective, there's no cost to it because they've already got a permit. And so there's no value in us dealing with the brine. But in other cases, a group's ability to produce fresh water may be limited by their existing permit for brine discharge. So maybe the market demand for water is X, but they can only produce, 75% of X because they can't discharge more brine. So if we can eliminate some of that brine, then they can actually produce more water. So, the economics of our projects are contingent on a lot of things, which makes it hard to say precisely what is the price of carbon removal. I know that's a bit of an evasive answer, and I apologize for that, but I mean, our goal is to, get to under $100 per ton
Yeah.
of carbon removal.
Got it. Okay. Yeah, I just want to make sure because I know that some of these technologies and the way they sell them, they're selling them at crazy numbers, and it's like, okay, well, we need to make it more economical. We need to bring this cost down. And that's what I wanted to push into because the website says, that it's commercially viable and it's available today, right? And to move through these things a little bit quicker, just to touch on the point of when you say it's available today, you're meaning that it's using existing technologies, not some like future moonshot thing that we may or may not figure out, right? That's the reason behind that.
Sure. And over time, of course, we can, as membranes get more advanced, we can incorporate those technologies into our processes. But having viable projects is not reliant on a membrane advancement.
Yeah, understood. That's great. That's very helpful to clarify. So thanks for that.
I mean, one of our moonshots is that we're working on now is, we've been. The carbonates themselves are a cost to store. And so that increases our costs. But what if the carbonates themselves were a source of revenue? Well, how do you do that? Our moonshot is you use that as a vehicle for ocean alkalinity enhancement. So, the oceans have absorbed more than 50% of all CO2 since the Industrial Revolution. They're becoming acidic. If you put an alkaline substance in them, that buffers that acidity. And so we've been working with a number of research institutes to basically model what would happen if you add our carbonates to the ocean. That's, you know, that of course is going to require a lot of research, a lot of, you know, permitting and consents, but I think we can get to the point based on, you know, what we're learning already that, you know, we will one day be able to sell those credits as well. And then we will transform what is a significant cost for us, which is the storage of the carbonates, into a further revenue stream. And then, you know, we can further reduce the cost per ton.
I think this, the way that you laid out, you know, I think at least three different sources of revenue, three different options of what this product can be attractive, is usually, I think, akin to a lot of what we hear in venture capital with, you know, taking bets for shots on goal in terms of, you know, what is the go-to-market that can get you to scale? And what is the go-to-market that can get you to that $100 million revenue business, right? So it's really great to see with deep tech and a climate tech focus that there is that same optionality with the kind of technology that you're innovating on. I wanted to get your perspective on that go-to-market. You know, when you're looking at these different bets and possibilities of making revenue, are you seeing traction for some above others?
Yeah, I mean, I think a problem that a lot of DAC groups face fundamentally is people want these projects in the abstract, but it doesn't mean they want them in their community, right? So I can be in support of direct air capture, doesn't mean I want it in my neighborhood, right? So, you know, a lot of DAC groups say, well, it's going to create jobs and it's going to create these, you know, local economic benefits. That's true. But our approach is that, you know, we supply water and communities want water, particularly in many, you know, water-stressed parts of the world. Because we integrate with an existing water facility, we have a much smaller footprint than a standalone DAC facility. Not only that, but we're interfacing with a group that has a mandate to deliver water to its constituencies. And so I think, you know, that's not an economic advantage, but it is a go-to-market advantage. Because if you think about it, there's no local constituencies that are tasked with providing carbon removal for their communities. You know, your typical small town does not have a carbon removal, you know, board or, you know, municipality, right? And so if we can meet a customer problem, which is water and brine management, this gives us a means of deploying direct air capture that a group that just has direct air capture does not have.
Definitely. And I think, you know, focusing and indexing on not only the big picture problem, but your edge within it that provides real tangible benefits like the focus on water. That makes a lot of sense. I think there's a lot of, you know, heads in the clouds approaches to deep tech that don't really focus on that.
One thing I just want to make a comment to bring this back. I think it's really important to highlight this, and then you can continue, Samuel. Is that what you're saying, Luke? Is that you found a way to have an alignment with a group that already has a job to do, right? And you're helping them to do their job. So you have champions of your product, not people fighting against it, which is what typically happens in local communities with a lot of these things. They're afraid of change, et cetera. So I just want to like highlight that to anybody listening, because I think that that is extremely important, and I want to make sure we don't gloss it over. So continue.
No, I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, it's typical that startups that have at some point have a pivot, right? That's kind of the common story. And I don't think we had a pivot so much, but you know, we saw ourselves first and foremost as a DAC group that had a water co-benefit and a brine management co-benefit. But what we have learned with our initial customers is from their perspective, we are a water group that deals with brine that has a nice carbon capture co-benefit. So, you know, from their perspective, the carbon capture is a nice ancillary benefit, but it's not really the core value proposition that we provide.
Yeah, I think that's a really cool example of how when you put something out there, people will have their own reasons for loving, you know, the technology and the product as a whole. So it's really cute, cool to hear all that feedback, you know, from your experience. One thing I want to do is also take that, you know, success that you've had an understanding of what is valuable for the customer. How did you navigate bringing that into your conversations for raising? From what I can see, you've raised, convertible debt, as well as received a grant. So this, there's a bunch of different ways in which you articulate your message, right? So when you're interacting with these different, capital deploying groups, how are you navigating the fact that you can call yourself, a main beneficiary of water providing versus, direct air carbon capture? How are you navigating that messaging?
Yeah, I mean, there was, as you may know, on the heels of the Department of Energy's announcement on the DAC hubs, Carbon Engineering, which was, one of the big recipients of that, was acquired by Occidental Petroleum. That was purchased for more than $1 billion. And a lot, I saw several, comments on that by kind of big shot investors that they obviously did very well, their investors did very well, and the group that can do this and not have a water problem, because many leading DAC groups are actually massive freshwater consumers. So a group that can accomplish carbon capture and not have a water problem, really has even better possibilities. I think, we've discussed these kind of two addressable markets, carbon capture and water. And we have another addressable market as well, which is critical mineral recovery. And so a lot of these brines actually have, critical minerals in them, whether that's lithium or manganese or any number of things. And again, this gets to basically an economic synergy, which is to get at these minerals, you first have to get rid of the salts. And so it comes back to the salts issue. I don't want to, portray that we're kind of, boiling the ocean, in going after everything, but that is, we have some things that are being basically propelled by grants that we can continue to study to kind of work on, and that is one of them, whether or not we can, if we deploy this, say, New York is sitting on a big aquifer that has a lot of salts in it, has a lot of lithium in it, and it's hard to get to that because if you're just doing lithium recovery, it's not viable. But if you could stack the benefits of freshwater production, lithium recovery, direct air capture, then suddenly what was a non-viable project becomes potentially quite profitable.
So was this then the point you had reached when you mentioned at the beginning that you went out and raised 3 million within a couple months? Did you already have this conceptualized and you understood, hey, we know that we're going to provide more than just direct air capture? Because if I'm not mistaken, if I'm guessing correctly, you raised at the time when it was a little bit easier to raise. So I don't know if that had to do with it. I'm curious to understand that more, as well as the grants, how you obtain the grants, and any advice on other companies, how they obtain, like, the advice around getting grants.
We raised the 3 million prior to, fully understanding some of these economic synergies. We've, since raised another 5 million. And we're, targeting a pretty significant Series A in the next 6 months. We raised the 3 million in many ways on the backs of, the April 2022 announcement by the IPCC that, we would need to get to gigaton scale of carbon dioxide removal in order to stay within the 1.5 Celsius warming targets of the Paris Agreement. So, we started out first and foremost as a DAC company, but, as we've progressed and as these kind of various circular economy strategies have become more and more apparent to us, we've become more of a, a decarbonization company.
Got it. So then on the topic of, you mentioned you're going to be raising soon. So there's somebody, Matt McGraw, has come on the show recently and talked about the difference. Everybody says hardware is too hard to fund, takes a lot of extra money. But I saw a chart he actually shared on LinkedIn, I think it was today, that kind of showed the funding for software. It's usually just like this kind of gradual line. It goes up until they get to big rounds. But with hardware, it's kind of like nothing, 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 and it spikes, right? Because they get to a point where the technology works, and it's just simply, okay, now we know how to do it, we're going to deploy it. Are you like, I don't know how much you can speak to it or how much you haven't, haven't raised the round yet, but can you speak to that process of, okay, once we got to this point, then investors were suddenly like, okay, perfect, it works, like we it makes sense, and then it becomes a little bit easier. Is that, can you speak to that at all?
Sure. I mean, these sort of first of a kind facilities are really challenging, and this is something that climate tech companies generally face. In our case, one of our big grant, one of our big breakthroughs was being a recipient from the California Energy Commission for our Palmdale project. So we received $8.1 million for that project. And that's really critical in building that project. As you said, software is cheap and hardware is not. And so fundamentally, it requires a lot of capital to get these things started. Now, over time, as you have proved out your technology, as I said, the unit operations are well proven, but the some of the integrations are unique, and so we do have to prove those out. After proving this out, then suddenly this becomes something that subsequent facilities can be financed. And so in California, we were the first, I believe we were the first clean tech company that was approved by the iBank for their loan guarantee program. So, this is another government program that is pretty essential for us to build a facility. Because if you just go to a bank and say, I want to build this unique facility, right? It's too complex of a story. It's, particularly for a pre-revenue company. And there's just not really the environment for this. The Department of Energy has a loan guarantee program, but I think it's a minimum of $100 million. And so it's just and this is a this is a gap that the groups are identifying, and not just for our sake, but like for the planet's sake. If there are groups with great ideas that need $5 million to prove them out, like this shouldn't be an insurmountable obstacle, right? And it's very hard to raise venture funds to build a facility because that's not the sort of returns that, venture capitalists are looking for. So this is kind of the valley of death in this space. And I think we're going to cross it through to, because of some of these programs, but it's a real challenge.
Yeah, just one comment, I think, and then we can move on to the next section, is that you mentioned a point which is very obvious from coming off of Climate Week. This will be posted a couple, like 2 weeks after Climate Week, but we're recording right 1 week after. There was a lot of discussion around bridging that gap and using a different type of set of tools for the capital stack to build hardware, right? Because again, it's not necessarily that much more money, especially if you have some grant money in there and you know how to obtain the grants. You can actually, get to the point where it's proven, and then it's just an infrastructure play, right? Then you can get really, really cheap capital, to go build these things. And I'm very excited talking to you because this reminds me, of some of the other comp founders we've had on, where it seems like you're getting really close to that inflection point in a much shorter time than some of these people did. And you're getting really close to it, and then these big infra funds can come in.
Yeah, and it doesn't hurt that my partner is, was a finance professor and a Federal Reserve, regulator, and so
That must help a little.
he knows these systems intimately. But it, if I would think if you have two co-founders that are coming off, PhDs in material science, I mean, they may be brilliant individuals, but whether or not they're going to be able to navigate these systems, I mean, it's been very hard for us, and we have people that are, pretty savvy in these areas.
Yeah. Note to self, make sure to find a co-founder that regulated the Fed prior. All right, we can go to the next section now.
Yeah, no, I was gonna say, it sounds like you really got a good
team behind you, and you know, hopefully everyone can find sort of a way to navigate the systems that easily, because it's not easy. And even having the technical expertise we've seen at times isn't enough. And I think that's actually, you're making my job easy for me. That's a pretty good segue. You know, looking at this space, we're coming up on the last segment of the show, really. And we always love to give, you know, advice to founders who listen to this episode and get inspired, and are currently either working in the space or want to get interested in it. So across the areas of fundraising, you know, go to market, how you found your product market fit, how you got talent, you know, managing the team, generally speaking, like, what are your top three pieces of advice for founders?
I mean, obviously there's a lot of non-dilutive funding in this space, and you know, teams should think through how to access that because that's important. You know, in the case of some of our grants, we found you know, national labs as partners. You know, when you're a startup, you obviously don't have that kind of, you know, name brand recognition, credibility with grant making organizations. So, you know, who are your partners on those grants? And can those partners add, you know, credibility to your initial efforts, I think is an important strategic consideration. As far as talent goes, I think that's been something that's been either we've gotten lucky, or what I actually suspect is there's just a lot of really bright, talented people that want to make a difference in the climate space. And so it's been pretty easy to recruit, you know, very smart, competent, hardworking people. You know, it's I think a lot of people, when I hear discussions on these topics, they think about this almost purely from a economic perspective, and we do as well, but I think it's also you are deploying, you know, physical projects in places. So how do you actually get community buy-in? That's not something that's just purely based upon the economics of projects. So there is some, you know, some discovery there, that, you know, you can't shortchange that any more than you can shortchange, you know, customer discovery, right? That's a process of trying to figure out, you know, what it is that, you know, communities want, how to make these projects palatable. We're in the one of the DOE DAC hubs, the Cal DAC hub, and a lot of that is trying to figure out how to deploy these projects in a way that is responsible and, you know, is wanted by communities. So I don't know if those were three things.
No, I think it's good. I think I'll just reiterate the point you made earlier. I think that founders really should take away, if you ask me, which is making sure that you have those alignments correct, right? If you are trying to do something where you have to convince the community that it's a good thing, it might be a little bit tougher than if you have some really key stakeholders who already know the community to help you with that. With that said, then, let's our favorite, probably my favorite part of the show always, part of the reason I started the show is to just ask you kind of what are your ideas for if you were to go like you suddenly carbon, suddenly Capture 6 evaporated and you had to go, no pun intended, then you had to go start a new company. What would you do it in? What kind of technology would you work on?
Can I take a vacation first?
Yes, you get a 2 month vacation.
Let's see. If I'm staying in the climate space, maybe something else in kind of geoengineering, you know, broadly speaking. You know, it's been very, it's been very apparent the last few years, you know, how vulnerable forests are to forest fires. I don't really have a forestry background, but I'm kind of curious what sort of innovations come out to, you know, make forests more resilient, to, you know, intervene quicker, to It's like you're in New York, right? I mean, New York a few months ago was the sky was red. It was apocalypse. So that's interesting. I mean, I find I really find these kind of circular economy projects really interesting. Just maybe it just aesthetically appeals to me, but just thinking about kind of these system synergies and even though it's a bit simple, this kind of mantra of how one company's trash becomes another's treasure and vice versa. I think that's that's a really appealing thing to kind of to progress. I was in some conversations yesterday where I was talking to some people about Africa, where I used to work a fair amount. And on the education space, I think like how can maybe low and middle income countries participate in these sorts of clean tech projects? They can't offer the same tax credits that, Europe or US can, but how do you build capability there? I do have an education background, so I'm sort of interested in that kind of workforce perspective and capacity building. So I might be interested in something like that.
Super cool. And you mentioned one thing I wanted to follow up because you talked about like how, one day New York woke up and the sky was red. Our most recent interview that's out right now with T from OpenESG, similar situation where I think there was just so much not paid attention to. And all of a sudden the problem was so real. Everyone started to, I think, embody the same thing you said, which is, one person's trash is another person's treasure. Looking at every part of the problem and saying, okay, where can you make value out of this? So I definitely think that had a really big impact on where we are.
I was in Kiribati a few months ago, and we're trying to do a project in Kiribati. And Kiribati is consistently ranked as, one of the most five vulnerable countries to climate change because, it's only a few feet above the ocean, and so one good tide, and the whole country is submerged. But I think, while indeed, places like Kiribati are very vulnerable and require support, I think that narrative of vulnerability, while it's true to some extent, it's also created this sense in many of us that, well, we don't live in a vulnerable place, right? And I think the last couple of years, there's been this dawning recognition that, no, in fact, vulnerability is everywhere, and that is the nature of climate change. And so, I'm hoping that that continues this kind of groundswell of momentum for climate change response, is this shared recognition that, we're in this together. There's, this is not just Bangladesh's problem or low-lying, parts of, Kiribati, but this is really all of our problem.
Yeah, I think that's a really good place to wrap things up. I think it is important. People have realized that there's no more haven cities. I think I just saw a post last week about this, that this idea of like a haven, oh, climate change doesn't really affect this place. Those are going away very quickly, right? Everybody's going to deal with it. Even the people I'm familiar with from Wisconsin, where everybody's like, oh, it's not climate change, it's just the weather, just how it is in Wisconsin, right? It's getting to a point where it's pretty bad. But one thing I did want to just put a dot on is that when last week at the Climate Capital Summit, Chris Sacco spoke, and he mentioned something about geoengineering, which apparently some people are very, very like cautious of, right? So very people are really cautious to do any of these things. But he pointed out that there are some times where we do things that actually are net negative for what we're trying to do. One of them he mentioned was the smoke from, I think it was diesel ships that crossed the ocean, had created a layer of clouds that was actually cooling the ocean. So once they cleaned up those fuels, it actually had a net negative or net warming impact on the ocean. So I think it's important for people to remember that if you think that these things are really bad, just remember we've already been geoengineering the Earth just unintentionally. So maybe
That's
as long as we're doing it, with intention, we should be okay. But any last points you want to make, and where people can reach you?
sure, and it's always important to remember when we talk about something like geoengineering or ocean alkalinity enhancement, we can pursue this in a responsible way, right? Us doing ocean alkalinity enhancement doesn't mean we dump 100,000 tons of our carbonates in the ocean tomorrow and say, oh, what's going to happen? Right. You start out with a gram and you measure it and you do modeling and so there's ways to pursue these responsibly. And to your point, we already are engineering the planet. So being afraid of further of intentionally engineering the planet seems more silly to me than unintentionally engineering the planet, right? So yeah, this was great. Thank you so much for your time. I'm on LinkedIn, and that's probably my social media platform that I am most active in. But I really appreciated this dialogue and the work you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for coming on. I think it was a great discussion. We got through a lot that we could have talked about more, but we're out of time. We'll maybe see how you guys go, and we'll have you on again in a year or so. But thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you.